doubt. He's a nosy neighbor and he's an unwelcome guest. He'll pester you. He'll irritate you. He'll kick the stool out from under you and refuse to help you up. He doesn't offer any solutions. He only raises questions. Have you had any visits from doubt lately? Max Lucado suggests you put a lock on your gate, post a do not enter sign on your door. James 1:6 says, anyone who doubts is like a wave in the sea, blown up and down by the wind. Well, doubt prompts a broad range of opinions. To some, doubt represents rank unbelief, and to others, doubt exposes more of the raw side of honesty. It breaks down to this: can we have lingering doubts and remain a person of faith? Strong and capable people on both sides disagree. The great reformer Martin Luther had absolutely no place in his thinking for doubt. He scored few things more scathingly than what he termed that monster of uncertainty, a gospel of despair. But Alfred Lloyd Tennyson, on the other hand, wrote, there lives more faith in honest doubt, believe me, than in half the creeds. So down through the centuries, the church has had representatives on both sides. On the one hand, there have been the Jonathan Edwards and the George Whitfields and the Dwight L. Moody's, whose strong pulpits have rung with just such assurance, you wonder if, when you read their sermons, if any of them even had an occasion to doubt. On the other hand, God has given us his church, C.S. Lewis and Flannery O'Connor and Blaise Pascal and more recently Philip Yancey, who have encouraged us to question. In fact, John Ortberg, in his book, No Doubt, K-N-O-W, Doubt, says, embrace your uncertainty. It's a gift. Believers doubt. Seekers doubt. The churched doubt. The unchurched doubt. In my own struggle with faith-shaking doubt, tracing the line between belief and unbelief and finding it is less a dividing line between hostile camps than a razor's edge that runs through every soul, mine, yours, even those known for their deep faith. So whether you're a believer, a seeker, stumbling in your faith, or sitting on the fence with your arms crossed, wondering what all the fuss is about, it is possible for doubt to be one of those unwelcome guests of life that sometimes, in the right circumstances, good for you. Real, palpable, painful doubt leads to truth. And that certainly is a cause for celebration. Is it possible for faith and doubt to coexist? Well, there's one desperate parent in the New Testament who would answer that question with a resounding yes. He's the father of a demon-possessed boy who in anguish turned to Jesus for help. His has been a long, dark night of attempting every imaginable remedy for his son's horrifying and tortured madness. Nothing worked. The scene that Mark's gospel includes captures, like few others in the Bible, the very real conflict between hope and despair. Mark 19, verses 19 through 24. Jesus said to them, bring the boy to me. So they brought the boy. But when the evil spirit saw Jesus, it threw the child into a violent convulsion, and he fell to the ground, writhing and foaming at the mouth. How long has this been happening? Jesus asked the boy's father. He replied, since he was a little boy. The spirit often throws him into the fire or into water, trying to kill him. Have mercy on us and help us if you can. What do you mean, if I can? Jesus asked. Anything is possible if a person believes. And the father instantly cried out, I do believe, but help me in my unbelief. Max Lucado writes about this doubting dad. There are times when faith seems effortless. Prayer is sweet. The Bible seems alive. Worship is heart-stopping. Faith becomes sight when you just know. Then there are the long stretches of life where faith is a dogfight. Nothing seems certain. You feel like you're drowning in a tsunami of trials. And God, for whatever reason, seems like he's moved and left no forwarding address. And if that's where you are, you need to meet the father whose son suffered a trifecta of troubles, unable to speak and epileptic and possessed by a demon. In those verses we just read in Mark 9, since toddlerhood, the evil spirit has been throwing the child into fire and water, trying to destroy him. How much faith could you muscle up in this situation? Yet to his credit, the man was still clawing and clinging to hope. He approached Jesus and pleaded desperately, if you can do anything, take pity on us and help us. As prayers go, this one is hardly textbook. It doesn't ooze faith. In fact, that phrase, if you can, conveys the idea that this case is probably out of your league, Jesus, but I figure it can't hurt to ask. And when Jesus responded by saying that miracles are tied to faith, immediately the boy's father responded, I do believe. Help me overcome my unbelief. And that's what C.S. Lewis meant when he said, we must lay before him what is in us, not what ought to be in us. And it's also a perfect picture of most people most days living with an uncomfortable mixture of both faith and doubt. Faith isn't fixed. It's fluid. It's like a muscle. And when we exercise faith, it grows strong. But when we ignore it and cultivate our doubts, it atrophies. So give the poor man credit. With his faith on life support, he at least had the spiritual wherewithal to approach Jesus. He seemed to grasp the teaching of Christ. Apart from me, you can do nothing. And that includes believing. Daniel Taylor, in his book, The Myth of Certainty, doesn't choose to use the term doubting Christians. He refers to doubters among us as reflective Christians. And frankly, that works for me. There's not much dignity in doubt, but there's a touch of dignity in reflection. And according to Taylor, a non-reflective person asks what could be worse than unanswered questions. And to him, the reflective person would consider unquestioned answers his or her struggle. A reflective Christian is one who is thinking deeply, questioning often. And when we doubt, our minds are actually at work. When life takes us through unexpected twists and tragic turns, when we're overwhelmed by the tough stuff of doubt, thankfully the Bible doesn't leave us awash in our questions. A familiar story in John's Gospel shows us the answer to much of our doubting is a person. His name is Jesus. And he did for one struggling disciple. As for us, he helps us in our unbelief, transforming lingering questions into a more stabilized faith. Chuck Swindoll asks, Do you remember doubting Thomas? Of course you do. Talk about a bad rap that stuck. My heart goes out to the poor guy. I'd rather think, thanks to Daniel Taylor's analysis, I'd rather think of him as reflective Thomas. He's one honest disciple who didn't check his brain at the synagogue door. He had faith in his doubts when his questions weren't answered. And he had the guts to question the crowd, to raise his hand and press for answers that made better sense. And I call that kind of honesty not only reassurance, but valiant. I would love to see the ranks of Christianity filled with more courageous believers willing to declare openly their struggles, to weep when they're hurting, to admit their doubts rather than deny them. John chapter 11 portrays a raw expression of doubt in the midst of life's tough stuff. And here's where we meet our man Thomas, his mind engaged, his faith against the ropes. 2 days after hearing of Lazarus's death, Jesus announced to his disciples that he was going to Judea, where Lazarus would certainly be buried. And the disciples knew of the danger of going back. Jesus was public enemy number one on Judea's most wanted list. And to complicate things, the religious leaders were already breathing vicious threats against his life. And so, not surprisingly, the 12 apostles attempted to dissuade Jesus. And that saying, Lazarus is dead. And I'm glad for your sakes that I was not there, so that you may believe, let us go to him, Jesus insisted. Well, at that point, something remarkable happened. Reflective Thomas, the one haunted by doubts, spoke up. John writes, therefore Thomas said to his fellow disciples, let us also go, that we may die with him. A chill had no doubt run the length of Thomas's spine when he heard Jesus talk about going back to Bethany, but that chill was quickly transformed into iron resolve. He knew the danger, and apparently he resigned himself to an irreversible decision to follow Jesus regardless, a decision that would eventually cost him his life. Yet doubt lingers in Thomas's words. And New Testament scholar Merrill Tenney writes, his faith was courageous, but not triumphant. He was resigned to the possibility of martyrdom as a matter of duty, and he didn't entertain the concept of victory over death in all of its powers. Faith had not yet passed from resolution to insight. And all that Thomas could envision in the trip to Bethany was certain death. And I call that reality. But he didn't know of anybody he'd rather die with than his master and his other disciples. And I'd call that loyalty. John chapter 14 shows that Thomas had his doubts about the future too. They'd come to Jerusalem. It was there Jesus stood in the darkening shadow of the cross. He slipped away to a second-story flat in a busy city where he found he and the 12 disciples could gather for their final meal. Jesus had broken the news to them that his death would be near as separation for them was certain. And as he scanned the room, he saw fear and doubt in their eyes. And that's when he spoke what are perhaps some of his most precious words, tender words, as he attempted to calm their worried minds and steel their shaken resolve. You know the verses in John 14, don't let your hearts be troubled. Believe in God, believe also in me. In my Father's house are many dwelling places. If it were not so, I would have told you. For I go to prepare a place for you. And if I go and prepare a place for you, I will come again and receive you unto myself, that where I am, there you may be also. And you know the way where I am going." Jesus had hardly finished his words before Thomas blurted out, "Lord, we don't know where you're going, and how do we know the way?" You have to love his unguarded honesty. The rest of the men were thinking the same thing, but only Thomas had the guts to say so. He wasn't arguing. He wasn't trying to stop the plan. He was stating the truth. He didn't have a clue where Jesus was going. So he questioned Jesus' comment, "You know the way." The fact is, he didn't, and none of them knew. And that's why he asks, "How do we know the way?" And Jesus said to him, "I am the way and the truth and the life. No one comes to the Father but through me. And if you had known me, you would have known my Father also. And from now on, you know him and have seen him." Now think this through. If Thomas hadn't asked that question and expressed his doubts, it's possible Jesus might never have uttered those remarkable words, words in fact that have brought both hope and comfort to the world since that day. So good question, Thomas. Good for you. In the midst of the tough stuff of doubting, Thomas is willing to say, "I don't have this theology thing all cleaned up in my mind. It isn't clear to me, Jesus. There's something about this heaven talk I can't weave together in my thoughts." And without a hint of rebuke, Jesus graciously worked with Thomas, respected his doubts. He understood his confusion, his fear, his grief. Truth be told, Thomas's heart was broken. His dreams had been shattered, his hopes dashed. His plan to hold stock in a triumphant earthly kingdom were belly up in a single declaration of intent. And not long after that honest interchange between Jesus and his disciples, Thomas watched from a distance as Jesus endured a violent, tortuous death. He saw the blood spatter on the road. He saw those thick iron spikes disappear deep into Christ's hands and feet. He grimaced as the sword pierced his side, and suddenly everything was over. And with that, reflective Thomas went AWOL, vanishing into the shadows of that confusing, depressing day in Jerusalem, leaving the man devastated. Thomas simply checked out. Warren Wiersbe: "It's an encouragement to us to know that the Lord had a personal interest and concern for doubting Thomas. He wanted to strengthen his faith and include him in the blessings that were in store for his followers. Thomas reminds us that unbelief robs us of blessing and opportunities." And it also explains why Jesus didn't rebuke Thomas. He didn't say, "Hey, look in your notebook. I covered that in the discourse on the Mount of Olives, page 9, check it out." But he said, in effect, "Thomas, your questions will be settled in me. I am the way. I am the truth. I am the life." How could he be the way when they found themselves at a dead end? How could be the truth when it all appeared to have been a hoax? How could it have been the life when they had just been told of his impending death? More unresolved questions lingered in Thomas's fractured soul. So for 3 days after Christ's death, that's called a dramatic pause. For 3 days after Christ's death, the disciples grieved, haunted by fear, dogged by doubt. That then Jesus came and appeared to them, and all of that changed. John remembers the transforming encounter. John 20, beginning at verse 19. So when it was evening on that day, the first day of the week, when the doors were shut and the disciples were for fear of the Jews, Jesus came in the middle of the in their midst and said to them, "Peace be with you." And when he had said this, he showed them both his hands and his feet. And the disciples then rejoiced when they saw the Lord. So Jesus said to them again, "Peace be with you. As the Father has sent me, I also send you." But Thomas, one of the 12, called Didymus, was not with them when Jesus came. With his hopes dashed and his dreams gone, Thomas was nowhere to be found. He was lost in his doubts and disillusionments. And wherever he was, the remaining disciples did find him and exclaimed to him, "We have seen the Lord." But that was not enough for our reflective friend. He wanted tangible proof. And that's why Thomas said to them, "Unless I see in his hands the imprint of the nails, put my finger into the place of the nails, put my hand into his side, I will not believe." Once again, Thomas owned his doubts. He didn't blindly believe because others did. It would take more than a few excited friends to convince him that the horrible events that he had witnessed only days before had been somehow miraculously reversed. He wanted to touch Jesus' hands, to feel the deep longing of the imprint of the nail scars, to put his finger into the spear wound in his side before he'd come around. And that's what Jesus had in mind for Thomas. John writes of this event also. Verse 26, 8 days later, when the disciples were together again, and that this time Thomas was with them, the doors were locked, but suddenly, as before, Jesus was standing before them. "Peace be with you," he said. Then he said to Thomas, "Put your finger here. Look at my hands. Place your hand into the wound in my side. Don't be faithless any longer. Believe." And Thomas exclaimed, "My Lord and my God." Thomas, having honestly faced his doubts, discovered a firm faith. Once convinced, he yielded. We get through the tough stuff of doubt the same way, by facing those doubts and bringing them to the Savior, just like Thomas. Any question asked without guile is not a skeptical question. It's an honest search. And Jesus very graciously responds, "Thomas, because thou hast seen me, thou hast believed. Blessed are they that have not seen and yet have believed." You are the "they" in that sentence. Blessed are you who did not see and yet believed. Blessed are you, Judy and Deb and Kim and Greta and Nicole and Lynn. And blessed are you. Blessed are you, Mark and John and Will and Bob and Chris and Mike. Blessed are you who haven't seen yet believe. Blessed are you for bringing your doubts to him, for leaving them at the foot of the cross. It is there at the cross where those who can no longer cope with life's doubts are able to work things through. It's the place to which all of us must come, and sooner rather than later. Throughout any life that is lived realistically and reflectively, we come to impossible places where we feel we cannot cope. They may not seem like it, but these are actually healthier places in life. They are also sometimes the hardest. When the bottom drops out, when the pain seems unbearable, when some unbelievable events occur, doubts arrived unannounced. Don't deny them. Acknowledge them. Those times of doubt become schoolrooms of learning. As we work our way through them, a new kind of faith is forged. It will come slowly, and that's healthy. It's being shaped on the anvil of God's mysterious plan, some of you of which you'll never be able to explain. And that's okay, for we know that all things work together for good, for the good of those who love God and according to his purpose. Selah.